Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Monrovia, Indiana, is the spot where the great filmmaker of American places, Fred Wiseman, took his blood sample of heartland Trump country. First finding is Monrovia doesn't talk much about Mr. Trump. It talks basketball, as here in a high school classroom.
Yeah, I don't think people realize just how dominant we were at basketball. Read a book about this. In the 1920s, high school basketball was known for Kansas, Indiana, and New York City. So like this was like one of the three hotbeds for high school basketball in the nation. And from Monrovia, you have three people who are in the College Basketball Hall of Fame. Three. Tiggy Lambert has ties to Monrovia. They're not strong, but he's known as a Monrovia boy. John Wooden was born at Hall. 10 times he coached UCLA to national championship. Branch McCracken's from here. He won 2. So our town has ties to 12 national championships, more than any other town in the nation.
Monrovia speaks in Fred Wiseman's movie for the corn-farming flatland that American dreamers used to flock out of after high school to basketball stadiums and boom towns east and west. Monrovia today is the old hometown we don't much get anymore. Mike Pence country that went 3-1 for the Trump ticket in 2016, an aging, shrinking piece of the mental map, having a turn now at speaking for the country and to the world. Enter the filmmaker Fred Wiseman, unmatched as a watcher and listener to American places over 50 years now. Fred Wiseman, of first fame in 1967 with Titicut Follies in medieval Massachusetts. He settled into Monrovia for the long season between harrowing and harvesting last year. Welcome back, Fred Wiseman.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
The movie Monrovia is a marvel. Unsentimental listening and looking for 2.5 hours without blinking. Wonderfully open, I thought, to a heartland with a heart problem. Where do we begin? What did you learn about this country?
Well, at the risk of your thinking I'm not answering the question, what I learned is what you see in the film. If I could summarize it in 25 words or less, I shouldn't have made the film.
Well, that's your preface to summarizing it, if you want. But what did you go out there looking for, and what did you tell people you were after?
Well, I told people, I didn't know anything about Monrovia. I'd been in Monrovia for 2 hours before, about 5 weeks before, started shooting the film. And what I told the people when I went to Monrovia is that I wanted to make a film about a small town and daily life in a small town. And that I didn't know anything about Monrovia, so I had no preconceptions. And that I wanted to be able to visit the farms and the businesses and sort of the daily activities of the people, of the 1,300 or so people that live there.
And the state of our nation, our hometowns, our breadbasket is what, Dr. Wiseman?
Well, Dr. Wiseman doesn't like to generalize because there, I know from that great source, Wikipedia, that there are 23,000 small towns in America. And after 9 weeks in Monrovia, I know a little bit about Monrovia, and I've made films about two other small towns, Belfast, Maine, and Aspen, Colorado. But I don't. I resist the temptation to generalize.
But we learn maybe too many things. I learned, for example, that the American breadbasket does not eat well. It eats processed food, much too much corn oil, oversweet drinks. Michael Bloomberg would go nuts looking at the convenience stores. But start there. I also felt these are very good people, basically, but they're diminished and they're not happy.
Well, I would agree with you. They're extremely nice and kind to me and very helpful in making the film. the judgment, I mean, I wouldn't make any judgment whether they're happy or unhappy. I don't mean to be judgmental. I'm not sure I know what that means.
I'm jumping the gun here, but I picture you so much like Dr. Chekhov in Russia in the 1880s. He's going into the hinterland and saying, there's something waiting, and it's not good here. We know now it was a pre-revolutionary time, a decline of Tsarist regime and many other things, but he looked very, very closely, and he didn't come back with simple answers. But wait a sec, just for starters, let's talk about how Monrovia talks, and listen. And we'll listen also to your magic with the sound of public meetings, a sort of trademark of Fred Wiseman. The town council, in this case, has a problem with hydrants that don't seem to work for new housing.
You know, there was a time when we didn't even have those flush hydrants. And so you are going to be dependent upon the tanker truck and mm-hmm. a pond that you might have on your property that they can fill up from or what have you. That's part of living in the country.
I didn't buy a pre-existing house, and I had it built right across the street from what I thought was a fire hydrant. The builder certainly didn't offer that information that, hey, by the way, you know that's not really a fire hydrant there. Many of the people I've talked to, and probably the same people you've talked to, Bonnie, that, and you too, Phil, have said, we weren't told, we didn't know, we seen these red things sticking up out of the ground where you connect hoses to, and assumed that was a fire hydrant. I mean, granted, I'll be the first one to tell you, I was born and raised in Indianapolis, and they're yellow there, but they still look the same. It looks like a fire hydrant to me. It turns on like a fire hydrant. So, you know, a rose by any other name is still a rose.
That's more than I ever knew about hydrants. I didn't know about flush hydrants. But the tone of the town is democratic. It's respectful. It's civil. What did you hear on that score?
Well, no, I agree with you. The meetings of the town council, which are representative of various factions and points of view in the town, they were very civil. As far as I could see, the people treated each other very nicely, and and they got along. I think, you know, the issue is more one of awareness of the outside world. I think it was Monrovia is a very self-contained world.
Yep, to a fault. Yeah.
I don't think Monrovia is unique in that respect, because I think we all have our little islands of knowledge and vast areas of ignorance. But between the people who were happy, you know, with their lives, with their religion, and with their explanations.
What I'm hearing, Fred, is that the ugliness we associate with Trump time, Trump discourse, is not coming from Monrovia.
It's coming from Trump.
Exactly. But so what is the connection here? These are more than decent people. You'd be happy to meet them on the street. They might be happy to meet you.
Yeah, they're very decent people. I am no political savant. What the attraction of, I find Trump so odious. I don't know why. I can't understand how anybody is attracted to Trump.
They were by a score of
three to one. Monrovia, again, according to Wikipedia, voted 65% for Trump. But, you know, I mean, if I were to offer explanations, I would just run down the checklist of explanations that I've read in the New York Times.
But I don't know, but I kept wondering, could these folk be led in another direction? These are sort of what I remember as sort of Hubert Humphrey people, Hubert Humphrey towns. They're not anti-government. They're not anti-China. They're not anti-Mexicans. These are decent people with a sense of their own tradition.
Right.
And I don't think they're dying either. Well, they are dying.
No more than the rest of us are.
True. But they're not Richard Brody in the New Yorker, wonderful review, found something disastrous happening here to the American soul. I didn't see that. I didn't feel it. Did you?
No. I mean, no more disastrous than usual. But I think I don't like, you know, facile explanations of other people's political views.
I'm glad you left the politics out, but you didn't cut it out exactly, did you?
Well, no, I didn't cut it out because nobody talked politics while I was there. I was quite surprised
at that.
That's
the wonder.
I mean, I pray if somebody had talked politics, I may well have included it. But in the 9 weeks that I was there, I didn't hear any political conversation at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the sense of what was going on nationally. The political conversation I heard was what was going on in the town council, you know, three examples of which you see and hear in the film.
And in one of them, there's a moment when a lady says, people are mad about something. And I thought, God, that's the mildest sort of political madness you could imagine.
No, I was quite surprised, given what I'd read in Wikipedia about how the town had voted, that there wasn't more. And I didn't think it was because I was there making a movie, because most of the time, I was there in the town 10 or 12 hours a day, and most of the time you're not shooting. And I don't think people were concerned about having their political views recorded. They just didn't talk about it.
In the town council, they're agitated about land values and people coming in or not coming in. It can go both ways. They're worried about property. Anything else deeper, you know, in their middle of the night wakings?
Well, I don't know about their middle of the night wakings, but I mean, they in the town council meeting, they were concerned about the economic survival of the town, maintaining the character of Monrovia, the consequences to their way of life of adding a new housing development. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're very, very practical questions.
Yep. And there's almost nothing you feel that's bothering that they don't think they can talk about.
No, but
Hold it there for a moment, Fred. Fred Reisman is our guest. His movie is Monrovia. Coming up, Monrovia compared to what? Fred Reisman's America is an array of 40-some distinctive places by now. This is Open Source. Monrovia, Indiana, is one place among many in the Fred Weissman catalog of 40-plus films. This is a filmmaker who can find a world inside a mental hospital or an army base or a Chicago housing project. On the diversity scale, maybe the far pole from Monrovia was In Jackson Heights, his movie about a neighborhood of Queens in New York City.
Year after year after year, as you go along the parade route, you're going to see many families, people from different countries. The Colombians will cheer when the Colombian group marches by. The Ecuadorians will cheer when the Ecuadorians, and I shouldn't have gotten started with nationalities, because now everybody will want their nationality mentioned. Dominicans, South Asians, Bangladeshis, Indians, Colombians, Irish. Let's hear it for the Irish. Yeah. Italians, Puerto Ricans, Jewish, Dutch, the Dutch, German,
don't forget the Moldavians.
Moldavians, the Maltese, all come out and want to be a part of this. But that is what probably affects me the most, is to see the young people out here. And you know, when this parade started 22 years ago, some people were not even born when it started. And they've grown up with this parade here in this community, and they've never known that prejudice or that hatred in this community because of the visible presence of LGBT here. We're just interwoven. And I have always said that Jackson Heights is the only neighborhood where we could have done this in those days, because Jackson Heights is the most diverse community in the whole world, literally. We have 167 different languages spoken here. We are very, very proud of that diversity. Let's salute that, and let's all be proud of what we have accomplished here.
That's just a bit of Fred Weisman's blue state, urban America. What would those energetic, out, various folk of Jackson Heights make of of Monrovia, Fred?
Well, probably the same thing the people of Monrovia would make of
I was going to ask that
too. Jackson Heights. I mean, they're different worlds, and I think it you know, it's condescending to think that one is better or more sophisticated or more open than the other. I mean, they represent different kinds of values. I think a lot of people in Jackson Heights might find Monrovia strange, and a lot of people in Monrovia would find Jackson Heights pretty strange.
Strikes me that they may be two countries, really.
Well, or more.
Yeah, thank you.
But, I mean, one of the things that interests me is how people live very self-contained lives, that they're not curious about what's going on 15 miles away, or let alone 2,000 or 5,000 miles away. And that religion can satisfy their doubts and that worlds can be created without skepticism or irony or doubt.
What if we just dropped or banned red state, blue state? I mean, what's so beautiful about your work, Fred, is you don't categorize. You're not judging, at least as I don't feel you're judging, and you're open to everything, any surprise you might see.
Yeah, well, that's what I try to be in any case. Yeah, because what happens in the movies is always a surprise. Because I don't have a script. I don't set out to prove or disprove a thesis. I wait for things to occur, and I like to think that I recognize them. I mean, I don't create the sequences in my movies, but I recognize them.
Let's talk about them. We've been revisiting your 40-plus film archive, trying to imagine, I must say, a complete master edition for the ultimate sort of binge. But I'd love to draw you out on some of the highlights, starting with Titicut Follies, a truly heartrending expose of a Massachusetts state hospital for the criminally insane, as they were called, in the 11th century, I want to say, but it was 1967. And here's a young man pleading that he's perfectly all right, except that his Bridgewater confinement is driving him crazy.
You'll be a fool if I see enough improvement in you.
But how can I improve if I'm getting worse? I'm trying to tell you, day by day, I am getting worse. Because of the circumstances, because of the situation. Now you tell me, until you see an improvement. Each time I get worse. So obviously it's the treatment that I'm getting, or the situation, or the place, or the patients, or the inmates. Well, I do not know which. Well, I want us to go back to the prison where I belong. I was supposed to only come down here for observation. What observation did I get? You call me up a couple of times, you say, well, take some medication for the mind. I'm supposed to take medication for if I have some bodily injury, not for the mind. My mind is perfect. Because I am obviously logical, I know what I'm talking about, there's nothing, and I am excited. Yes, that's the only fault you might find with me, and I have a perfect right to be excited. I've been here for a year and a half.
What the doctor concluded was that he needed more tranquilizers.
But that sequence, the young inmate's name is Vladimir, and the sequence with Vladimir appearing before a board of psychiatrists and social workers and guards is the key sequence in the film, because Vladimir's critique of Bridgewater is 100% accurate. But it's also clear from other parts of the sequence that you didn't play that Vladimir has a problem, that he was transferred from Walpole, which is the maximum security prison, so-called normal prison, because he was having dreams that there were German soldiers buried around Walpole and that his coffee was poisoned. Vladimir had grown up in a DP camp in West Germany and was involved. He got picked up in the felony murder rules. The man he was in a car with held up a store and killed the owner of the store, and Vladimir was in the car, and so under the felony murder rule, he got 20 years, and after a while, he began having dreams that his coffee was poisoned and there were German soldiers there. So
they weren't German soldiers. They were Hungarian psychiatrists in the hospital. And they were loonier than the patients.
Yeah, it certainly, that was certainly true at Bridgewater. But the reason is the key sequence in the film is because his critique is accurate, but he also needs help. And the kind of help he needed was not provided. If he'd been a middle-class or upper-middle-class kid, he would have had access to a good lawyer and a good psychiatrist, and he never would have been in Bridgewater in the first place.
Would that be the case today, you suppose?
I don't know what's going on in Bridgewater, no. But around the same time, there was a case of a young woman who had killed her boyfriend and cut off his penis and sent it to his mother in Brazil. And she had a very good lawyer and good psychiatric treatment. She never went to prison. She was in a psychiatric hospital for a period of time, 5-7 years, and then was thought to be cured, was released, and has led a normal life ever since then.
You know, I've covered the trials.
Because she had good access to good psychiatric and legal services.
Yeah. Over the years, I just wanted to say, I mean, I've been through and covered the trials of Tittacott Follies, and I watched it again, beginning to end, last night. And, Fred, I just was amazed at what a brave and brilliant and utterly beautiful film it is. It's the best thing on Men in Confinement, this side of Dostoevsky's House of the Dead. I'll put it that way.
Well, that's a nice compliment. Thank you.
Well, a lot of Russians I'm comparing to you two. But it was it's just a heroic way to begin your career. In your movie Hospital in New York City, 1970, you shot this scene coming up with a young man who has taken a mystery drug. He doesn't know what it is, in Central Park. It's been making him vomit violently.
Okay, lie down. No, we don't need any more water. He's going to be okay. That was excellent. It all came up.
Oh, Doc.
That was excellent.
I don't know. Do I need a psychiatrist?
Yes, you do. And you're going to have one very shortly.
All I want is this woman, the friend of mine. I've been writing her letters in Europe, and I'm... But I haven't seen her in so many months.
Okay. Are you going to be okay? Let me just take your blood pressure here before I send you down the hall, okay? There's a psychiatrist down there who's waiting, and we'll talk to you very shortly.
But did you take the poison out?
We got the poison out. You saw it come out.
Oh!
Poison is out.
What am I going to do?
Poison is out.
I don't want to die.
You will not die. Poison is out.
I got to say, we're audio people in radio, but you are an audio guy, Fred. It's not about the movies at all. I know that's too strong.
No. You know, for a movie to work, you got to have a good picture, good sound, and good editing.
Is sound not simply amazing, what it conveys? I can see that poor devil. I can see the doctor, who's probably younger than the patient. The poison is out, he's saying.
Yeah, well, The young student, he'd taken mescaline, and the doctor gave him Ipecac, which makes you vomit. And he gave him a lot of Ipecac, and he started to vomit. But he, as a result, he vomited up the mescaline, and he survived.
What was wrong with that institution, Metropolitan Hospital?
What was...
Compared to Bridgewater, say...
Oh, well, I mean, compared to Bridgewater, Metropolitan Hospital was an island of sanity, accomplishment, and virtue. They had something like 500,000 clinic cases a year in the emergency ward and the clinics. It was the only city hospital between 42nd Street and, I think, 125th Street. Cases coming in all hours, day, night, weekends, et cetera. And, I mean... It's funny, when the movie appeared in 1968, somebody wrote a review saying that the white doctors and nurses exploited the black and Hispanic patients, which I thought was absolute nonsense because the white doctors and nurses were working their asses off to help whoever walked through the door. And there are literally hundreds of people walking through the door every day, and the doctors and nurses were working in 24-hour shifts to help people, and I didn't see any examples of discrimination of any sort. But there was a Marxist critic who knew without any experience that white doctors and nurses exploited poor people.
The question there, as it in Tittica follows, is how the devil did you get in just to put your microphone in a place where anything could happen?
I'm going to tell you for the first time. I've never revealed this great secret before.
The scoop. Let's hear it.
My great secret is that I asked.
Yeah, you said, could I come into your...
I said, I want to make a movie in the case of Metropolitan Hospital. I wrote a letter to the commissioner of hospitals and that I wanted to make a movie about the emergency ward and clinics of a hospital in New York. And he said, come down and visit a couple. He suggested a couple to visit. I visited one in Brooklyn and Metropolitan. I chose Metropolitan because it was in Manhattan and started shooting. Bridgewater took longer. It took me a year and a half to get permission.
Ah, and then it was a contest.
Well, once I got permission, I thought I was all set. But then it became Elliot Richardson, who was the man who got me permission when he saw the film, liked it. And when he thought his political career was going to be damaged, when it became known that he'd helped me get permission, turned against the film just to try and save his distinguished political career.
I was on the knife edge myself watching it again last night. The public claim to see inside a public institution and what the hell was going on against the horrific revelations by that young boy who had sexually abused his daughter as well as other children and is sort of unveiling his whole self right there on your camera. Did he have a right to privacy in that case or not? I mean, is that it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to talk about privacy in the abstract. If you have to separate the moral issues connected with privacy and the legal issues. Bridgewater was and is a maximum security prison financed by the state. The people who wrote the First Amendment to the Constitution didn't have documentary filmmaking in mind in the 18th century, but what they did have in mind was that government should be transparent.
Yep.
And so I rely on the First Amendment. And ultimately, after 23 years, the courts found that the film was protected by the First Amendment.
As well as a huge public boon to know what we didn't know. Next on my little list is high school, shot in a New Jersey school, and a gym teacher is preempting backtalk.
What do you mean you can't take gym? You get dressed in the morning?
Yeah.
Do you get undressed?
Yeah.
Well, you can get into a gym outfit.
I know.
All right, well, you get into a gym outfit. We'll decide that.
I have a doctor's thing.
I'm sick and tired of you talking.
My mother was in, though.
I spoke to your mother.
You were excused.
Now, look.
I'm going to the doctor today.
Now, look.
Wait a minute, Jeff, you were excused.
You better be in a gym outfit.
All right.
You better be in a gym outfit. We'll determine whether you take exercise or not. We'll determine that.
We'll determine that, he says. Any of those teachers left?
Well, that I don't know. But that was a scene in the man's job description was dean of discipline. And he came up to me the first day I was in the high school and said to me, if you want to see the culprits, you can see the culprits lined up outside my door at 8:35 every morning. And it was a hard place to stay away from because, on the one hand, you learned what he thought the values of the school were as he disciplined students for various infractions, like locking teachers up in the closet or having fist fights or whatever, or not wearing the right clothes. But it was also kind of situation comedy.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Were you rooting for anybody in that scene?
I was rooting for more situation comedy.
What is it about you, Fred Wiseman, and these multi-voiced impromptu meetings, surprising in many ways, institutional settings, and nobody's talking to you?
Well, I think they're distracted by my big ears so that, you know, they just go ahead, do their business. I mean, I don't know why anybody agrees to be photographed, but the fact of the matter is that it's never, I've been doing this for 50 years now, and it's never a problem. People don't look in the camera. They go about their business. And if they don't want their picture taken, they say no. But they don't act for the camera, or if they try to, you instantly know it because there's something artificial about their behavior.
But people are not self-conscious, you think, even before...
I don't think so. If they,
and this was before we all had cameras in our pockets and stuff.
Right.
What does that tell you?
That people aren't self-conscious when they're being photographed. That, I mean, I think it's because, I mean, I don't know what, sometimes you can say the explanation is vanity, you can say it's indifference, or you can say that people have their own repertoires, and it's very hard to suddenly change your behavior. You have a way of acting in a variety of situations, and that defines or sets limits as to the way you act in one situation or another. And it's if people could suddenly act differently, the pool of actors for Broadway and Hollywood would be much greater than it is, because everybody would be Meryl Streep, and that's not true.
But also everybody's working in their own space, pretty small.
But
stage.
I think it's also we all more or less think our behavior is okay. We don't necessarily see our behavior the way someone else sees it.
Yeah. Well, come back. I just can't get enough of your unpictured sound. It's extraordinary. Coming up, a little bit of Wiseman 101. There are no scripts. There's no explicit message. There are no interviews, as you may have noticed. And the real art... The Fred Wiseman art is in the editing process. This is open source. Fred Wiseman, the movie maker, is our guest with a new profile of Red State America titled Monrovia, as in Indiana, at an art house near you, and a lifetime of mastery in sound and pictures behind it. Fred, you helped invent the visual culture that we swim in now, all the magic tricks that anybody with a smartphone can dream of learning. I'd love to use the rest of this hour to get some Wiseman moments and advice into a sort of seminar. Let's begin with Law and Order from 1969, sound and pictures. Sound and pictures of a woman suspected of prostitution. She's being held, if we've got that tape, by police, hand around her neck.
Right.
Please, I'm telling you. I can't talk with you.
I'm telling you, Gail.
So I said, I'll tell you.
You're talking with one of our boys. Do you understand that now?
Yes, sir.
Yourself.
Okay, I'm not trying to fight back. I just want to choke me no more.
You're not being choked.
Don't choke me no more.
You're trying to treat me nice, that's all.
No, but he was choking me.
Well, he wasn't choking, you're imagining.
That was Kansas City, Missouri, not Brooklyn, New York, but it sounds very modern, very familiar.
Well, yeah, in Kansas City, Missouri, in 1968, for the police to make an arrest for prostitution, the undercover policeman had to have a price and an act. So he had to pick up the woman, bring her back to the hotel, negotiate, and basically get in his underpants and presumably at the last minute arrest her. Policeman in this case did that, let her, and then they got dressed. He led her down the stairs of the hotel. She knocked him down and fled. He got on the walkie-talkie. We were in the police car, came to the hotel. The busboy said she had fled to the basement. The police found her in the basement, dragged her out from under some old furniture, and one of the policemen started to strangle her in front of the camera. And he had his arm around her neck. And you see in the movie, the woman being strangled. Finally, he lets her go, and the woman says to the policeman who was holding her hands behind her back, he, referring to the strangling policeman, was trying to strangle me. And the other one says, oh, no, you're just imagining it. And you've just seen it. But, I mean, that's obviously an example of police brutality, but I think it's an example of what I was talking about a minute ago. I don't think the policeman would have killed her had we not been there. He was shaping her up into the police prostitute system and telling her not to screw around with the police if she gets picked up for prostitution. Just Don't knock the cop down the stairs. Go to the police station, get fingerprinted, get photographed, get fined, and you'll be back in the street in a half an hour. And he says that to her.
Surely when you watch the news of Eric Garner on the sidewalk in New York, I mean, could that have been shot today? Would you have intervened? I mean, what was different?
Well, I mean, I didn't. I mean, I like to think, and it's an easy moral choice, that if it had gone on another 30 seconds, I would have intervened. But I didn't have to make the choice because the cop let her go. And I was also aware of the fact that it was a good sequence.
And then there was the movie Basic Training in Vietnam time, with the scene that Stanley Kubrick may have stolen or adapted for his Full Metal Jacket. Did you stumble on that too, Fred? Was that a surprise?
Well, everything. You know, I went through basic training with a company at Fort Knox in Kentucky. So I went. I was there for the whole 9 weeks of basic training. So whatever the trainees did every day, we did every day. So when they were, in that case, they were marching off to a session where they were taught how to navigate a minefield. And they were allowed to sing what was basically an anti-war song by the drill sergeants.
I filed that under American humor. It's just American outspokenness.
Right. No, it's a good place to file it.
One more clip, and then I want to sort of I want you to instruct everybody with an iPhone about what to do and what not to do. But there was this beautiful Valentine you composed to the New York City Public Library.
I tell a lot of people, you have to, don't depend on anyone. Do it yourself, just believe in yourself and keep working at it. I couldn't afford to go to film school. I learned from the library. I learned how to type, I learned how to read a script, I learned how to do all that from the library. People say, why you didn't go to school? I was taking care of my kids, I couldn't afford it, couldn't find no job. So I learned from the library.
I gotta say about that fellow too, it's so wonderful, Fred, to hear and watch ordinary people, not politicians, not celebrities, not miraculous athletes, people not used to being pictured or heard, but very, very much themselves in their own voices. Is that a kick for you?
Well, I mean, that's really what my movies are about. My movies are about ordinary experience and ordinary people as they go about their lives. And
unfold that. I mean, what is, are you aware of that?
Well, I like to think I'm aware. I mean, the whole idea behind these movies is that there's tragedy, comedy, sadness, joy, banality in ordinary experience that can rival things you read about in great novels, which are imagined. And I don't imagine these sequences, I stumble across them and recognize them and then use them to create dramatic narratives.
You know, I wondered, I know and I understand why you say editing is everything. The movie is composed.
Well, I mean, you got to have good picture, you got to have good sound, and you got to edit it right.
Right. But take us into that making of an art. In Monrovia, for example, what is the connection between the order in which we see events, starting with the harrow on a gorgeous flat landscape, and ending in mourning? But how did you construct that storyline, so to speak?
Well,
or did you?
For Monrovia, I had 120 hours of rushes after 9 weeks of shooting. And then when I got back and started to edit, first thing I do is look at all the rushes, all the material that's shot. That takes me 6 or 8 weeks. And at the end of that, I put aside about half the material. And then I edit those sequences that I think might make it into the final film. And in order to edit the sequences that interest me, I have to delude myself into thinking that I understand what's going on within a sequence. Because unless I think I understand what's going on within it, I can't make the choice to use it or know how to edit it down to a usable form and know where to place it in the overall structure of the film. So the first aspect of it is to make, the first thing that goes on in the editing is to make the decision what sequences I want to use, edit them into a usable form, and then it's only when I've edited all the sequences that I think I might use into a usable form that I begin to work on the structure.
But in Monrovia, for example, when did you start noticing that there is a kind of thread of death in these conversations? The guys with the comb-overs in the coffee shop talking about a bypass or somebody has just died and he's taking it a little hard. But there are cemetery headstones, and the movie, in a certain sense, moves toward a long climactic scene around a funeral. Whether that's the moral or the sense of the picture or not, or a statement about the Midwest, who's to say, in the eye of the beholder maybe, but when did that surface to you?
In the last stages of the editing. Only when I had edited all the sequences that I thought I might use, then my job was to figure out an order for them and what the order that I selected suggested. So that there's a literal aspect, what's going on within a sequence, and there's the abstract aspect, what's suggested by the literal. And it's in the relationship between literal and abstract that the themes and the point of view emerge and the structure is found.
Do you write it on paper that
no.
the theme here is, or
no.
it just works itself?
No.
You're working with an amazing photographer, John Davey, in so many of
I've worked with John for a long time. Terrific photographer.
Is he ever in the editing room with you?
No.
Who else is there?
Occasionally an assistant. Most of the time, just me.
Is this like a picture puzzle in a certain way?
It's exactly like a picture puzzle.
Interesting. Do you think of compiling?
It's exactly like a picture puzzle, except that with a picture puzzle, you know that if you work hard enough, you're going to arrive at a preconceived view. And here, there's no preconceived view.
Do you imagine yourself putting a time capsule together?
No. I mean, people have said that about the movies, but I don't think of them that way.
What are you thinking? Is this
What I am thinking is, how can I make the best dramatic narrative out of my 120 or 200 hours of rushes?
Do you mind other people making abstractions that differ with yours? I mean,
no. I mean, with my material, you mean? Or on their own different films?
No. I'm thinking really of the Richard Brody review, in which he read in this movie Dead Souls in the American Heartland. I didn't see it that way. But he calls Monrovia a work of mourning for the American soul. Deep sigh.
Deep sigh, yeah. No, I resist generalizations like that.
Okay, that's fair enough. Again, I come back to Chekhov in pre-revolutionary late Russia, and I wonder if you're trying to collect our thoughts here about what could be a pre-revolutionary moment in post-industrial, late capitalist, digital USA. Are we losing our mind or are we finding it back in the heartland?
You know, I don't want to disappoint you, but I don't
think... You can't disappoint me.
I don't think in those terms. I mean, those abstractions are too heady for me.
Oh, come on. You're working abstractions all the time.
But not those abstractions.
Okay. But are the other people given permission to...
Other people can do whatever they want.
Okay, I have to ask you a question I'm asking everybody now over, say, 50 years old, and you've been noticing everything, Fred, with an eagle eye for more than 50 years. what happened in our time, in the time of, say, post-60s to 2018, this is a different country. And no one gives up on his or her country. But how did we get here? What were the turning points? What do we love? What are we terribly sad about?
I don't want to disappoint you in my answer, but I don't know how to answer questions like that because it's too vague. I mean, I'm not good at vast cultural generalizations. Whatever I have to say about what's going on in my time, I've said in the movies, individually and cumulatively.
What we don't hear in Monrovia is the voice of young Indiana, and we don't hear big ambition or ecstasy or enormous amount of projection into the future. But who among the characters we do hear would you want to bank on in that film? Did you like the most?
Well, what I like is what works for the film. I don't make judgments about what I like in terms of what's going on in the country or who I want to have a drink with. My attitude when I have the rushes is that it's material out of which my job is to construct a movie.
And you do it wonderfully. Let me take a leap here. I love the tattoo lady, and I love the guy she was painting. A huge guy with big arms, and she was covering it with the language of Psalms, which
His request.
Of course. What do we know about them? Did you like them as much as I did?
Well, I didn't, I didn't. It's not a judgment I made about them. I was interested in having I thought it was a good scene in a tattoo parlor, and I was struck by the fact that he was probably an Army veteran because there were references, military references, as well as religious references. Mm-hmm. And I was struck by the fact that those references were what he wanted tattooed on his body. And I thought the tattoo artist was extremely skillful. Hmm. But I didn't make any judgment about her personality because she hardly talked.
So what made it a good scene in your terms?
What made it a good scene was that there was this silent man getting a tattoo by a woman who was skilled in her art, and the messages that were being tattooed on his arm had a religious and military significance.
Yeah. I think that's what touched me, too. It wasn't Death Before Dishonor or For Mother or Roses or anything else. It had heart in it and thought.
Right.
Training, home training.
Well, it was some memorialization of his experience. And I discovered afterwards, it's not in the scene, I discovered afterwards that he was an Afghan veteran. But you know that the military meant something from him because of the choice of tattoo.
Do you miss interviewing people like that? I mean, that would be my instinct, would be to tell me something.
I think there's some great interview films made. Errol Morris makes great interview films. Marcel Ophuls makes great interview films. Mm-hmm. My style is different. I mean, I don't think my style is necessarily the right way. It's the way I like to work. Mm-hmm. And you get different results with different techniques. Mm-hmm.
As did your heroes and mine, too, in an amateur way, the Maisels brothers.
I don't know if the Maisels brothers are my heroes, but...
Well, I mean, you grew up with them, didn't you?
I knew one of them sort of a little, but... But they definitely weren't my heroes.
Wow. Okay. They were my heroes just for that famous movie that we've admired before, Salesman, shot on Gallivan Boulevard in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Fred Wiseman, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on Open Source. Fred Wiseman, director, producer, editor, and sound guy. For Boston listeners, you can see Monrovia at the Museum of Fine Arts next Saturday. It opens this weekend in Seattle, Detroit, Denver, Austin, Columbus, Ohio, Kansas City, and other good locations through January. check Fred's own website, ZipOrah.com. Our show this week was produced by a wonderful team, starting with Connor Gillies, ending with Matt Lissette and our engineer, George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our auteur. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.